said, "What?" "I notice you're dropping Cheney's name every chance you get. Is that where you got that?" she pointed. "Got what?" "That hickey on your neck." I put a hand against my neck self-consciously, and she laughed. "Just teasing," she said. "Very funny." "Well, I'd like to think you have a sex life."
"I'd like to think my sex life is private," I said.
"So who's this guy you're so hot for me to meet?"
"Marty Blumberg, Beck's company comptroller."
Chapter 18. I drove over to my office. I left Reba in the car, the VW idling, while I ran in and grabbed the manila envelope from my desk drawer. In the car again, I passed her the envelope and watched her out of the corner of my eye as I circled the block and headed for Passages. She removed the photographs and studied them as though viewing vermin through a microscope. She put them back in the envelope without a word, her expression impossible to read. I found what was possibly the last space in the underground parking garage, which stretched like a low-ceiling gray cavern that ran the length of the mall. We hiked to the escalator and went up to level one, where all the shops were located. Manila envelope in hand, Reba walked 2 paces ahead of me, forcing me to trot to keep up with her. She didn't seem as hyper as she had been, and for that I was glad. "Where are we going?"
"Dale's."
"Why Dale's? That's a dive."
"Not true. It's a Santa Teresa landmark."
"So's the dump," I said. Dale's was strictly a no-frills bar. People went there to drink, pure and simple. I could feel the now familiar conflict arise. Should I be protective and suggest we go somewhere else, or keep my mouth shut and let her take responsibility for the choices she made? In this instance, self-interest prevailed. I wanted to meet Marty Blumberg. We entered the place, pausing in the open doorway to get our bearings. I hadn't been to Dale's for years, but it looked much the same. Narrow room with a bar running along the left and a jukebox in back. There were 6 or 8 small tables jammed up against the wall on the right. The lighting was primarily of the neon beer sign variety, blue and red. There were numerous patrons on hand, occupying half of the bar stools and most of the tables. 87% of those present were smoking, the air as gray as morning fog. The overhead fixture made the light seem flat, very close to the quality of waning daylight outside. The jukebox, I remembered, was stocked with old 45 RPM records. At that very moment, the Hilltoppers were crooning, "P.S. I Love You," while a couple danced on a narrow expanse of floor by the unisex bathroom. The sawdust underfoot and the acoustical ceiling tiles muffled the noise level so that both music and conversation seemed to be taking place in another room. The walls were lined with black and white photographs, taken in the 40s, to judge by the ladies' hairstyles and clothing. Each photo featured the same balding, middle-aged man, perhaps the eponymous Dale. He had his arms slung around various minor sports figures, baseball players, professional wrestlers, and roller derby queens, their signatures scrawled across the bottom of the pictures. At the far end of the room, a concession-sized machine produced a steady spill of popcorn that the bartender scooped into paper cups and set out for general consumption. At intervals along the bar, there were collections of assorted popcorn seasonings, garlic salt, lemon pepper, Cajun spices, curry powder, and Parmesan cheese in a green cardboard container. The popcorn wasn't sufficient to keep patrons sober, but it gave them something to fiddle with between the downing of drinks. As we were taking our seats, a peevish argument flared up, the topic being politics, about which no one present seemed to have the faintest clue. "So, where is he?" I said, looking around the room.
"What's your hurry? He'll be here in a bit."
"I thought we were having dinner. I didn't know they served food in here."
"Well, they do. 7-way chili."
She started ticking off the choices on her fingers.
"Macaroni, chopped onions, cheese, oyster crackers, sour cream, or cilantro in any combination."
"That's only 6. You can have it plain.
Oh.
The next 45 selection came into play, and Jerry Vale launched into his version of It's All in the Game. Many a tear has to fall. I refused to think about Cheney, lest I jinx the relationship. A waitress appeared. Reba asked for iced tea, and I ordered a beer. I'd have ordered iced tea myself, but only to demonstrate a virtue I didn't actually possess. In the face of her sobriety, I was acutely conscious of every sip I took. I was also worried the minute I turned my head, she'd snatch up my beer and suck half of it down. As there was nothing else on the menu, we ordered seven-way chili, electing all six options. The chili arrived hot, spicy, and rich. The recipe, I noticed, was printed on our paper placemats. I was tempted to snitch mine, but the note at the bottom said, serves 40, which seemed excessive for someone who usually eats alone standing over the sink. You never finished telling me about passages and Beck's participation, I said. Glad you asked. I didn't think you'd pursue the subject. Here I am, I said. Care to fill me in? She paused to light a cigarette. It's simple enough. A developer in Dallas bought the land in 1969 and submitted all the plans. He thought it'd be a cakewalk. The guy was so optimistic he was already putting up signs, passages, shopping plaza, coming in the fall of 1973. The city planners had a ball, running him ragged with all the codes and requirements. He revised the plan 16 times, but nothing ever seemed to suit. 12 years later, when the developer still hadn't managed to get approval, he put the word out on the street and someone introduced him to Beck. That was 1981. The project was finished in 85, a speedy 3 years after construction began. I waited for the rest. I can tell by the look on your face you're not getting it, she said. Just tell me, okay? Guessing slows us down and makes me cranky. Well, think about it. How do you think Beck got all those approvals and permits? Because he's nice? I stared, feeling dense. Reba rubbed her thumb against her fingers in the universal gesture denoting money changing hands. Payoffs? Exactly. That's where the money went. The 350 thou I was accused of snitching. I delivered most of it myself, though I didn't realize what it was until later. All I knew was he had me driving to Helangon with these bulky manila envelopes. Granted, some of it was earmarked for the boys in Sacramento. Beck is forever greasing palms on behalf of pending legislation. But most was for local guys who had the power to say no. Once they pocketed the dough, they were more than happy to be of help. But that's political money laundering. Wow, you are quick, she said, rolling her eyes. Isn't that why you're setting up this meeting with the feds, to get the goods on him? I wasn't sure how far you meant to go. Right to the bitter end. But when we first talked, didn't you say he was depositing the money offshore so he could hide it from his wife? That's the story he gave me. I didn't figure out what he was really doing until the audit came up. I'm sure he's still funneling cash out of the country as fast as he can, but at least I get it now. His efforts were never meant to benefit me. I'm sorry. I know that's tough on you. Tough, but true, she said, her tone matter-of-fact. At 9 o'clock, just about on the dot, Marty Blumberg appeared. Reba had been watching for him, and she gave him a big wave and motioned him over the minute he walked in. He paused at the bar to light a cigarette. The bartender was already setting up his usual drink. Whiskey so dark it looked like coke. Glass in hand, he ambled over to our table. He was probably in his 50s, a good-looking guy once upon a time. Now he was overweight by a good 100 pounds, his wardrobe lagging one size behind. His trouser pockets bulged open like a set of ears, and the buttons on his shirt were straining against his bulk. He was baby-faced and florid, with sorrowful-looking blue eyes, a pug nose, and a full head of dark, frizzy hair. He seemed genuinely glad to see her. Reba invited him to join us, hooking a thumb in my direction by way of introduction. This is Kinsey Millhome. Marty Blumberg, she said. I said, "Hi, Marty, nice to meet you," and the two of us shook hands. Marty gave Reba a quick visual appraisal. "You're none the worse for wear. When'd you get back?"
"Monday. Kinsey drove down and brought me back. The whole experience was an education in what I don't know."
"I'll bet."
"I hear you're in the new offices. Nice to be so close. Dale's was always your favorite."
Marty smiled. "I've only been coming in the past 14 years. I could be part owner with all the money I've spent."
Reba took out a cigarette and Marty picked up her Dunhill and extended a light. Reba tucked a strand of hair behind one ear as she bent to the flame, her hand resting casually on his. She inhaled, her eyes closing briefly. Smoking was like prayer, something you approached with reverence.
"Beck said the offices are awesome."
"Pretty slick," he said.
"Coming from you, that's high praise. How about a tour? Beck said he'd show me around, but he's in Panama."
"A tour? Oh.
Sure, why not? Give me a call and we'll set it up."
"How about tonight? As long as we're down here, it would be a hoot."
He hesitated. "I could do that, I guess. I need to pick up my briefcase anyway and clean off my desk."
"You're cleaning your desk on a Friday night? That's devotion."
"Beck's new dictum. No files or papers on any of the surfaces overnight. Place looks like a showroom. I'm mostly playing catch-up, taking care of stuff I've let slide. I'll probably work tomorrow, too."
"The guy's a workaholic," she said to me as an aside, and then turned back to him. "Kinsey's a P.I., a private detective," she said, separating each syllable for emphasis. She turned to me. "You have a business card on you?"
"Let me look," I said. I fumbled in my shoulder bag until I found my wallet where I kept a stash of cards. Reba had her hand out, so I passed one to her, and she handed it on to Marty, who studied it, pretending it mattered when he couldn't have cared less. He tucked it in his shirt pocket.
"Guess I better watch my backside."
Reba smiled.
"That is so true, you have no idea." He shook a cigarette from the pack, placing it directly between his lips.
Smoking didn't seem like a good idea, as he was already wheezing.
Reba said, "Allow me," as she picked up her Dunhill, flicked it, and offered him a light.
"Such service."
"You bet. Tit for tat," she said. She propped her chin on one hand. "Aren't you curious what she's doing here?"
Marty looked from Reba to me.
"A drug bust?" "Don't be dumb," she said, giving him a smack on the arm. She leaned forward flirtatiously and murmured, "She's part of a task force. Federal and local dicks, looking into Beck's finances. All very hush-hush. Promise you won't tell."
She put a finger to her lips, and I could feel myself blanch.
I couldn't believe she'd laid it out like that, without a word to me.
Not that I'd have agreed. I checked his reaction. His smile was tentative as he waited for the punchline.
"No, seriously."
"Seriously," she said. I could see she enjoyed doling it out to him bit by bit.
"I don't get it."
"What's to get?"
"I'm telling you the truth."
"Why tell me?"
"Fair warning. I like you. You're right in the line of fire."
He must have been one of those men who operated with his body thermostat cranked up into the red zone, because his face now bore a sheen of perspiration. Without seeming to be aware of it, he took the flap of his tie and blotted the beads of sweat from his cheek.
"What do you mean? I'm right in the line of fire. How do you figure that?"
"Well, A, you know what he's been up to, and B, Beck won't go down for this any more than he'd accept blame for the missing 350 thou."
"I thought you volunteered."
"Stoopnagel that I am, I made it easy for him. I'd like to think you're smarter than me, but maybe not.
He can't do anything to me. I'm covered."
"You really think so? All he has to do is point. You've got your fingerprints on everything. You're the one who set up the accounts. Same with the offshore banks and the IBC.
"Exactly. I've got leverage on him. I'm the last guy on earth he ought to fuck with."
"I don't know," she said with skepticism. "You've been with him a long time."
10 years.
"Right. Which means you know a lot more than I do." So? So if he stuck it to me, he can stick it to you as well. Believe me, the trap's there. You just can't see it at this point any more than I saw what he was doing to me until it was too late. Oh, I got no beef with Beck. The guy takes good care of me. 10 years. You know how much money I've managed to sock away? I could retire any time I want, walk out tomorrow and still be living like a king. It may feel cushy, but it's a trap all the same. Marty was shaking his head. No. I'm not buying it. What if they lean on you? They who? The feds. What do you think I just got done telling you? The FBI, IRS, what's the other one? She asked me, snapping her fingers impatiently. Department of Justice, I said. She turned to me and frowned. I thought you mentioned a couple more. I cleared my throat. Customs and Treasury and the DEA. See, she said to him as though that explained that. Why lean on me? Based on what? Based on all the shit they've picked up so far. From who? You think they don't have agents in place? He laughed, albeit uneasily. What agents? That's bull. Sorry, I misspoke myself. I said agents in the plural. There's really only one. Who? See if you can guess. Here, I'll give you a hint. Who in the company has gotten close to Beck in the last umpty many months? She put a finger against her cheek, deep in mock thought. Starts with O. Ani? There you go, she said. Talk about a break. I get sent to prison and that gives her the chance to slide right in. She works for the feds? Reba nodded. Oh, yeah, for years. And trust me, little Miss Ani wants his ass on a plate. I don't believe it. Marty, this is her golden opportunity. You know how it is with women in these shit government jobs. Sure, they get hired. The guys let them do all the grunt work, but forget about promotion. There's no upward mobility without a coup of some kind. She doesn't pull this off, she'll be stuck where she is. Doesn't sound right. Are you sure? This makes no sense at all. The girl's dumb as a post. That's the impression she gives. But she's wily as they come. I'm telling you, she's good. You watch. This lady can write her own ticket, provided she nails Beck first. I mean, look at it this way. Does anybody in the company suspect? You sure as shit didn't. And Beck doesn't have a clue. If he knew what was going on, he'd be out the door like a shot, wouldn't he? Well, yeah. Meanwhile, there she is with a finger in every pie, access to everything. What a sweet deal for her. Marty seemed to be getting annoyed, though I noticed two blotches on the front of his shirt where the sweat was soaking through. Look, Reeb, I know you're pissed at him, and I don't blame you. Sure, I'm pissed at him, but I'm not pissed at you, which is why I'm here. I'm trusting you to keep your mouth shut. I haven't breathed a word of this to anyone else. She's after his balls. She's so gung-ho she's willing to screw the guy to get the drop on him. Marty was silent. I could hear him breathing as though he'd just finished running 6 blocks. You can't just make claims. I know. You're a man of common sense, and you're hard to convince, which is why I brought these. She slid the black and white photos from the envelope and passed them over to him. Marty leafed through them. Jesus! See what I mean? What's he thinking? He's not thinking. He's got his brain between his legs. Really, you hadn't guessed he was screwing her. You knew he was doing me. Yeah, but you made no secret you had the hots for him. This, I don't know. Shouldn't somebody tell him what's going on? Reba raised her brows and gave him the big eyes. You want to do that? Because I sure as hell don't. Poor guy. Poor guy, my butt. Are you kidding? If he was willing to work me over, why not you? Thing is, the stakes are bigger this time. You tell him about Ani, the only effect is giving him more time to cover his tracks. Marty held up his glass and rattled the ice. The bartender caught the gesture and began to make him another drink. Ani, I can't believe it. Beck must have walked right into it. Of course. Minute she makes her move, he'll turn right around and lay it off on you. He'll claim you acted on your own. He never authorized you to do anything. You took it on yourself. But it's his signature. Loan apps, incorporation papers.
Marty, get serious.
He'll say he's never had a head for the financial end of things. That's how I was able to get away with the money I stole.
Gosh.
Guess he should have wised up, but some guys never learn. You told him to sign, so he signed. He trusted you, and this is what he gets for it. Shamey shame on him. Meanwhile, you're under federal indictment.
Marty shook his head.
I don't know. This is freaking me out. The bartender brought his drink. Marty took out his wallet and extracted 2 20s. Keep that, he said. As the bartender left, he was well on his way to draining his glass. During the brief interchange between the two, Reba shot me a look. It's your show, I thought, before she glanced away. She patted Marty's arm, her tone brisk.
Anyway, ponder the implications, that's really all I ask. Even if you decide I'm making it up, it wouldn't hurt to cover your ass. Once the subpoenas are issued and all the warrants are in place, you'll be shit out of luck. In the meantime, if you're on your way upstairs, how about the two of us tagging along?
Chapter 19. I'd passed the entrance to Beck's office building half a dozen times without ever taking in the sight. The facade was thickly overgrown with ivy, integrated seamlessly into the architectural conceit of an ancient Spanish town. Flowering trees had been planted along the front. To the left of the entrance were side-by-side stairs and escalators, giving access to the additional parking structure at the corner of the mall. A high-end luggage shop occupied a portion of the ground floor, presumably paying Beck a big whack of high-end rent. We pushed through the glass doors that swung closed soundlessly as we entered. Windows stretched upward the full 4 stories to a slanting glass roof. The interior atrium was oblong, done in a mottled rosy granite, floors and walls forming a hard canvas on which natural and artificial light played according to the time of day. High on the wall there was a clock with long brass minute and hour hands and 6-inch diameter brass dots representing the hours. A curtain of dark green ivy and philodendron hung from a miniature oasis above the clock. There were 2 elevators on the wall, dead ahead. To the right of these, in an alcove, there were 2 more elevators facing each other, one with a much wider door, which I assumed was designed to accommodate freight. A digital readout next to each elevator showed that all were at lobby level. In the center of the lobby, a perfect circle of granite was sunk in the floor, sloping sides washed with a constant Niagara of water spilling from a 6-inch channel around its rim. The sound was soothing, but the look, I fear, was closer to toilet-like than the restful pool it was meant to suggest. A uniformed guard sat at a high-polished onyx desk, a lean man in his 60s. He had salt-and-pepper hair and a blank, handsome face. Briefly, I wondered what curious set of circumstances had landed him here. Surely there was little to guard and less to secure. Did he simply sit for the whole of his 8-hour shift? I saw no indication he had a book in his lap discreetly shielded from view. No radio or pint-sized television set. No sketchpad or crossword puzzle book. His eyes tracked us, his face turning slowly as we clattered across the cold expanse of polished granite floor. Marty lifted his hand and received an unblinking stare in response. Reba smiled at the guy, giving him the full benefit of those big dark eyes of hers. She was rewarded with a tentative smile. She caught up with Marty outside the elevator doors. What's his name? He's cute. Willard. He's on nights and weekends. Can't remember who's been covering days. We entered the elevator and Marty pushed the button for 4. You made a conquest. First time I've ever seen him smile, he said.
Getting along with guards turns out to be a specialty of mine, she said. Although, in my case, correctional officer is the appropriate term.
Since Beck's offices took up the entire 4th floor, the elevator doors opened directly into the reception area, hushed with thick pale green carpet. Lights blazed everywhere, but it was clear there was no one on the premises but us. Modern furniture and contemporary art were mixed with antiques. Etched glass partitions separated the reception area from an airy conference room beyond. From our perspective, corridors opened on four sides like the spokes of a wheel. The hallways appeared to stretch on at length, with wide bands of color forming sweeping loops along the wall.
Oh, Marty, this is gorgeous! Beck said it was spectacular, but this is really over the top. Mind if we look around?
Just don't take long. I want to get home.
I promise we'll make it quick. Think of it this way. If it weren't for that stint in prison, I'd be working here myself. Isn't there a roof garden?
The stairs are back that way. You can't miss 'em. I'll be in my office down that hall.
You could get lost in this place, Reba said.
Well, don't. Beck's not going to like it if he hears you've been here.
Mum's the word, she said, producing her dimples for him.
Reba circled the reception area, with me following in her wake. As long as Marty was present, she was almost childlike in her hand-clapping enthusiasm, popping her head into offices here and there along the way, oohing and aahing. He watched us briefly and then went off in the opposite direction. The minute he was out of sight, Reba dropped all pretense of touring and got down to business. I kept pace with her as she checked the names posted on the wall outside each office. When she reached Ani's, she shot a look down the hall to make sure Marty wasn't there. She moved to Ani's desk, grabbed a tissue from the box, and used it as she started opening drawers.
Keep a lookout, okay?
I checked the corridor behind me. Searching is my all-time favorite sport, except for the time spent with Cheney Phillips of late.
The edgy thrill of invading someone's private space is heightened by the possibility of getting caught in the act.
I wasn't sure what she was looking for, or I'd have joined her in the game. As it was, somebody had to stand guard. Still opening and shutting drawers, Reba said,
God, I can't believe Marty's so paranoid. Must be off his meds. Ah.
She held up a chunky ring of keys that she jingled mid-air.
You can't take those. Pooh! Ani won't be in until Monday. I can put him back by then.
Reba, don't. You're going to ruin everything.
No, I won't. This is scientific research. I'm testing my hypothesis.
What hypothesis?
I'll tell you later. Quit worrying.
She left Ani's office trailing a hand along the wall as she returned to the reception area, scanning the lines of the ceiling. When she reached the elevator, she circled the central core, measuring with her eyes. Large abstract paintings dominated the walls, and the lighting was such that one's attention was irresistibly drawn from one artwork to the next.
It would help if I knew what you were looking for, I said. I know how his mind works. There's something here he doesn't want us to see. Let's try his office.
I wanted to protest, but knew she wasn't listening. Beck's corner location was prime, spacious with clear cherry paneling and the same footstep-muffling green carpeting. The room was furnished with low-slung chrome and leather chairs of the sort that require winch and pulley action to remove yourself once you've been foolish enough to sit. His desktop was black slate, a curious surface unless he favored doing his long division in chalk along the length. Reba used the same tissue to avoid leaving latent prints on his desk drawers. I loitered uneasily in the doorway. Dissatisfied, she pivoted. She studied every aspect of the room and finally crossed to the paneled wall where she tapped her way across, listening for evidence of a hollow space behind. At one point, she activated a touch latch and a door sprung open, but the only treasure revealed was his liquor supply, complete with cut glass decanters and assorted glasses. She said, "Shit." She pushed the door shut and returned to his desk. She sat in his swivel chair and did a second survey from that vantage point.
"Would you hurry up?" I hissed. "Marty could show up any minute wondering where we went."
She pushed the chair back and leaned down so she could examine the underside of his desk. She extended her hand. almost to the length of her arm. I wasn't sure what she'd discovered, and I didn't care to be a witness. I stepped out into the hall and looked toward the reception area. So far, no Marty. Idly, I noted the fact that the paintings were graduated in size, with the largest near the elevators and the smaller ones in diminishing proportions back here. From the viewpoint of a visitor, the effect would be to create the illusion of corridors much longer than they were, an amusing trompe-l'oeil effect. Reba emerged from Beck's office and grabbed me by the elbow, steering me toward the wide stairs that led up to the roof. "What's up there besides the roof garden?"
"That's why we're going up, because we don't know," she said.
She took the steps two at a time, and I kept pace with her. A glass door at the top opened into a fully landscaped garden, trees, shrubs, and flower beds separated by gravel paths that meandered out of sight. Landscape lighting made the whole of it glow. Chairs and umbrella-shaded tables were placed in assorted patios that were dotted throughout. A 4-foot wall encircled the perimeter with dazzling city views in all directions. Central to the garden was what looked like a gardener's cottage, the exterior encompassed by trellises on which gaudy passion-flower vines wound up and across, thick with purple blossoms. There was a sign, half-concealed in the profusion of greenery. Curious, I pulled the foliage aside.
"What is it?" she asked.
"Danger. High voltage. There's a number for the building supervisor if work needs to be done. Must be a transformer or maybe part of the electrical service, who knows. I guess it could be housing for the elevators, along with central heating and air conditioning. You have to put stuff like that somewhere." The little building seemed to hum in a way that suggested you'd be fried to a crisp if you made one wrong move. From the stairway, Marty called up to us. "Hey, Reba, up here. I don't mean to rush you, but we ought to get going. Beck doesn't like strangers on the premises."
"I'm hardly a stranger, Marty. I'm his favorite screw."
"Yeah, well, he'll be pissed anyway and take it out on me."
"No problem. We're ready any time you are," she said, and then to me, "Take your car keys and wallet out of your shoulder bag and leave it behind that thing."
"My bag? I'm not going to leave my shoulder bag. Are you nuts? Do it." Marty appeared at the top of the stairs, apparently not trusting us to come down the stairs on our own. He leaned against the stair rail, his breathing stertorous from the climb. Reba crossed to the landing and linked her arm into his, turning to admire the mountains visible in the distance.
"What a view! Perfect setting for an office party."
Marty took out a handkerchief and wiped his face, which was glistening with perspiration. "We haven't done that so far. Good weather, the gals eat their lunch out here and grab a little sun. Bad days, they use the break room like they did at the old place, only this one's fancier."
"The break room? I didn't see that."
"I could show you on the way out." Reba turned to me.
"Everything okay?"
"Right behind you," I said. The two started down the stairs. Grousing to myself, I'd done as she'd instructed, removing my keys and wallet from my bag, which I shoved behind a big potted ficus tree. I hoped she knew what she was doing, because I sure as shit didn't. Looking back, wistfully, I moved toward the stairs. I caught up with him in what looked like a mid-sized kitchen. Sink, dishwasher, 2 microwaves, a side-by-side refrigerator freezer, and 2 vending machines, one with soft drinks, the other with candy bars, potato chips, peanut butter crackers, cookies, packages of nuts, and other fatty snacks. There was a large table in the center of the room surrounded by chairs.
"Is this great?" she said.
I said, "Swell." "You ready?" Marty asked me.
"Sure, I'm fine. It's been fun."
"Good. Let me get my briefcase and I can lock up." The three of us proceeded down the hall toward the elevators. As Marty passed his office, he ducked out of sight and reappeared with his briefcase. Reba leaned around the doorframe.
"Nice office. Did you do this yourself?"
"Oh, God, no. Beck hired a design firm to handle everything except the plants. We have another company for those."
"Pretty highfalutin," she remarked.
We watched as Marty pushed the elevator button, calling the car from down below. While we waited, Reba pointed to a third elevator on the far side of the reception desk.
What's that for?
Service elevator. It's mostly for hauling cartons up and down, file cabinets, furniture, stuff like that. We have 15, 20 firms on these three upper floors. That's a lot of office supplies and copy machines, plus the cleaning crew uses it when they come in.
Bart and his brother still work weekends?
Fridays, same as ever. They'll be coming in at midnight, he said.
Nice to know some things don't change. The rest is a major upgrade. Might know Beck would do that as soon as I'm out the door.
The elevator arrived and the door slid open. Marty reached around and pressed the door open button while he entered the alarm system code on the keypad to the right. Reba displayed only cursory interest. Once the three of us got on, Marty released the button and pressed one for the first floor. We descended without saying much, all three of us watching the digital floor numbers flash from 4 to 3 to 2 to 1. As we emerged, the doors to one of the two elevators in the alcove opened, and a two-man cleaning crew emerged with their cart and loaded a vacuum cleaner, assorted brooms and mops, industrial-sized bottles of cleaning solutions, and packets of paper toweling to resupply the restrooms. Both wore coveralls with a company logo stitched across the back. One gave Willard a nod, and he returned a one-finger salute. Reba watched the two men cross the alcove and enter the service elevator.
What are they up to?
Marty shrugs. Beats me. I think they work on two. The doors closed behind them, and the three of us continued to the entrance, while Willard made a note of our departure time with the same blank stare he'd given us before. Marty didn't bother to nod his goodbyes, but Reba gave Willard a merry finger wave.
Thanks, Willie. Nighty-night.
He hesitated and then lifted a hand.
Did you see that? True love, she said.
We went down to the lower-level parking garage. At the foot of the stairs, Marty said, I parked over here. Where are you guys? That way, I said, pointing in the opposite direction. Reba shoved her hands in her jacket pockets and watched him walk toward his car.
Hey, Marty.
He paused and looked back.
Think about what I said. You don't act soon. Beck's gonna have your nuts in a vice.
Marty nearly spoke, and then seemed to change his mind. He shook his head, his expression withdrawn, and turned on his heel. She watched until he was out of sight, and then the two of us walked the length of the garage.
I didn't like the look of those cleaning guys, she said.
Would you give it a rest?
I'm going on record. There's something bogus about them.
Thanks for telling me. I'll put a note in the file. When we reached the VW, I unlocked the door on my side, slid behind the wheel, and then leaned over and unlocked the passenger side door for her. She got in and pulled the door shut, but when I went to insert the key in the ignition, she put her hand out.
Hang on a minute.
Why?
Because we're not done yet. Soon as Marty pulls out, we can have another go.
You can't go back up there. How are you going to pull that off?
We can tell Willie you left your shoulder bag upstairs and you have to have it back.
Reba, you got to quit this. You're going to screw up the government's case.
It's the government that screws up. Look at the state we're in. The country's a mess.
That's not the point. You can't violate the law.
Listen to you, Miss Prissy-ass. What law?
Shall we start with breaking and entering?
That wasn't breaking and entering. We went up with Marty. He let us in of his own free will.
And then you stole the keys.
I didn't steal them. I borrowed them. I intend to put them back.
It doesn't matter. I'm telling you, I'm through with this, I said. I turned the key in the ignition, shifted gears, and backed out of the space.
Don't you want your bag?
Not now. I'm taking you home.
Tomorrow morning, then, and I swear that'll be the end of it, okay?
I'll pick you up at 8.
Why so early? It's Saturday. The mall doesn't open until 10.
We'll be long gone by then.
Having done what?
You'll see.
Uh-uh.
No way. You can count me out.
You don't come with me. I'll do it on my own.
No telling what kind of trouble I'll get into. I would have closed my eyes in despair, but I was already pulling up the exit ramp, and didn't want to crash in my haste to get us out of there. I turned right on Chapel. Out of the corner of my eye, I saw Reba pull something from her jacket pocket, saying, "Well, this is cool." "What?" "Looks like I stole something after all." "Naughty me." "You didn't." "Yes, I did. These are Beck's. I found him in his desk in that Mickey Mouse secret drawer. Must be planning to skip town, the little so-and-so." She was holding up a passport, a driver's license, and assorted documents. Abruptly, I pulled over to the curb, greatly annoying the driver of the car behind me, who leaned on his horn and made a rude hand gesture. "Give me those," I said, grabbing for them. She held the documents out of my reach. "Hang on! This is the real deal here, a passport, birth certificate, driver's license, credit cards. Garrison Randell, with Beck's photograph. Ha! Must have cost a mint." "Reba, what do you think's going to happen when he realizes that stuff's gone? How's he going to know? How about he looks in his drawer the minute he gets back? That's his means of escape. He probably checks the docs twice a day." "You're right," she said. "On the other hand, why would he suspect me?" "He doesn't have to suspect you. All he has to do is figure out who's been in. Once he gets a bead on Marty, it's over. Marty's not going to risk his neck on your account. You'll end up back in the clink." She thought about that. "Well, okay. I'll put him back in his desk when I return Ani's keys." "Thank you," I said. But I knew I couldn't take her at her word. I dropped her at her place and rolled into my apartment at 11:15. The red message light was blinking on my answering machine. Cheney, I thought. There was something erotic in the very idea, and like one of Pavlov's dogs, I nearly whimpered in response. I pressed the button and heard his voice. 8 words. "Hey, babe, call me when you get in." I punched in his number, and when he picked up, I said, "Hey, yourself, did I wake you?" "I don't mind. Where have you been?" "Out with Reba. I have tons to report." "Good. Come on over and spend the night," he said. "I'll make you French toast in the morning if you're good." "Can't. She's picking me up here at 8. "How come?" "Long story. I'll tell you when I see you." "So, how about I come get you and take you home in the morning in time to meet her?" "Cheney, I can handle the drive. You're only 2 miles away." "I know, but I don't want you rattling around the streets at this hour. The world's a dangerous place." I laughed. "Is that how it's going to be? You're all protective and I'm docile as a lamb. You have a better idea?" "No." "Great. I'll pick you up in 10, he said. Chapter 20. I waited for him outside, sitting on the curb wearing a black turtleneck t-shirt and one of my new skirts. This was the third night in a row I'd be seeing him. Like a winning streak at the craps table, the roll was bound to come to an end. I couldn't decide if I was being cynical or sensible in acknowledging the fact. I knew how the night was going to go. In the first moments of seeing him, I'd feel neutral, glad to be in his company, but not irresistibly drawn to him. We'd chat about nothing in particular, and gradually I'd become aware of him, the smell of his skin, his face in profile, the shape of his hands as he gripped the steering wheel. He'd sense my attention and turn to look at me. The minute we made eye contact, that low, distant humming would start up again, vibrating through my body like the first rumbles of an earthquake. Curiously, I didn't feel I was in danger with him. Having blundered so often in relationships with men, I tended to be cautious, remote, keeping my options open in case things didn't work out. Inevitably, things turned sour, which only served to reinforce my wariness. In retrospect, I could see that Dietz played the game exactly the way I did, which meant I was also safe with him, but for all the wrong reasons. Safe because he was always off somewhere, safe because he probably wasn't capable of coming through for me, and safe, most of all, because his detachment was a mirror of my own. I heard Cheney's car long before he turned the corner from Bay onto Albanil. His headlights flashed into view, and I got to my feet, silently cursing the loss of my shoulder bag. I'd been forced to pack, if you want to call it that, a few things in a paper sack like a kid's brown bag lunch. Clean underwear, a toothbrush, my wallet, and keys. Cheney was driving with the top down again, but when I got in the car, I realized the heater was turned on full blast, which meant that half of me would be warm. He spotted the sack. "That's your overnight case?" I held up the brown bag. "It's part of a matching set. I have another 49 just like it in my kitchen drawer." "Nice skirt." "Thanks to Reba. I wasn't going to buy it, but she insisted." "Good deal." He waited until I'd fastened my seatbelt, and then he pulled away. I said, "I can't believe we're doing this. Don't you ever sleep?" "I promised you a house tour. Last time all you saw was the bedroom ceiling." I held up a finger. "I have a question."
"What's that?"
"Is this how you ended up married so fast? You meet old What's-Her-Face and spend every night with her for the first 3 weeks. Week four, she moves in. Week five, you're engaged. And by week six, you're married and off on your honeymoon. Is that the way it went?"
"Not quite, but close." "Why, does that bother you?"
"Well, no. I just wondered how much time I had to get the invitations out." Cheney conducted a tour, starting with the downstairs rooms. The house was more than 100 years old and reflected a way of life long past. Most of the original mahogany fireplaces, doors, window trim, and baseboards were still intact. Tall, narrow windows, high ceilings, transoms above the doors to aid the circulation of air. There were 5 working fireplaces on the first floor and 4 more in the bedrooms upstairs. The parlor, a concept that has since gone the way of the dodo bird, continued into the morning room, which in turn opened onto a gracious screened-in porch. In the adjacent laundry room, the old double tubs existed side by side with a wood-fueled stove for heating water. Cheney was in the process of redoing the living room, where the hardwood floor was covered in canvas drop cloths. Wallpaper had been steamed off and lay in discouraged-looking clumps. The plaster had been patched, and the window panes had been taped in preparation for painting. He'd taken off one of the doors, which he'd laid across 2 sawhorses and covered with canvas to provide a surface for any tools not in use. The brass hardware, doorknobs, lock plates, window latches, and pulls were jumbled into cardboard boxes in one corner of the room. "How long have you had the house?"
"Little over a year."
Additional drop cloths extended through a set of glass-paned pocket doors into the dining room, which was in marginally better shape. Here the latter paint cans, brushes, rollers, paint trays, and liners, not to mention the smell, attested to his having primed and painted, though he hadn't yet replaced the fixtures or the incidental hardware which littered every sill. "This the dining room?"
"Right, though the couple who owned the place were using it as a bedroom for her aged mother. They converted the butler's pantry into a makeshift bathroom, so the first thing I did was tear out the toilet, shower, and sink, and restore the built-in china cupboards and silverware drawers."
Through the bay of dining room windows, I found myself looking into Neil and Vera's kitchen next door. Cheney's driveway and theirs ran parallel, with a modest strip of grass separating the two. I could see Vera standing at the sink, rinsing dishes before she put them in the machine. Neil was perched on a stool at the counter with his back to me, the two chatting as she worked. No sign of the children, so they must have been in bed. I seldom witnessed even the briefest moments of a marriage in progress. Occasionally, I'd be struck by the sight of one of those couples in restaurants who spend the meal not looking at each other and not exchanging a word. Now that's a scary proposition. All the minor day-to-day frictions with none of the companionship. Cheney put his arms around me from behind and laid his face against my hair, following my gaze.
"One of the few happy couples I know."
Or so it would appear. He kissed my ear.
"Don't be a cynic."
"I am a cynic. So are you."
"Yes, but we both have a streak of optimism way down deep."
Speak for yourself, I said. Where's the kitchen? Through here. The previous owners had done extensive remodeling in the kitchen, which was now a streamlined vision of granite counters, stainless steel appliances, and high-tech lighting. Far from detracting from the overall Victorian feel of the house, there was a wonderful sense of hope and efficiency at work. I was exploring a walk-in pantry the size of my loft when the telephone rang. Cheney caught the call, and his end of it was brief. He replaced the handset on the wall-mounted phone. That was Jonah. There's been a shootout in a parking garage on Floresta. One of my hookers got caught in the crossfire. I said I'd drop you at your place and meet him at the scene. Sure thing, I said, thinking. Great. Now that Jonah knows we're an item, the entire STPD will be informed by midday tomorrow. Men are worse gossips than women when it comes right down to it. I crawled into bed at midnight and found myself tossing and turning, possibly because of the lengthy nap I'd taken in the afternoon. I don't remember the moment when I sank into a leaden sleep, but vaguely I became aware of a pounding on my door. I opened my eyes and checked the clock. 8:02. Who the heck was it? Oh, shit. Reba was down there. I pushed the covers back and swung my feet out on the floor, yelling, "Just a minute!" like she could actually hear me. I dry-washed my face, pressing my fingers into my eyes until light sparks appeared on the inside of my lids. I went downstairs and let her in, saying, "Sorry, sorry, sorry, I overslept. I'll be with you in a sec." I left her to make herself at home while I went upstairs, though in the interest of good manners I leaned over the loft rail and called down to her, "You can put on a pot of coffee if you can figure out how." "Don't worry about it. We can stop off at McDonald's. You got a deal." I did an abbreviated bathroom tour and then pulled on jeans, a t-shirt, and tennis shoes. I retrieved my wallet and car keys from the brown paper bag, and in 6 minutes flat, I was ready to go out the door. We ordered from the takeout window, and then sat in the parking lot with two enormous coffees and four Egg McMuffins with extra packets of salt. Like me, Reba ate like she was competing for the land speed record. "They don't call this fast food for nothing," she remarked, her mouth full. There were a scant few minutes when we sank into quiet, focused on our food. Having finished, we bundled up our trash and shoved it in the bag, which Reba pitched into the container on the sidewalk nearby. She said, "2 points, hot damn." While I sipped my coffee, she reached over to the rear seat and picked up three rolled cylinders of architectural plans, bound with a rubber band. She slipped the band on her wrist for safekeeping, then unfurled the first oversized sheet, which she spread across the dashboard. The paper itself was a whitish blue, with the two-dimensional rooms laid out in blue ink. The legend along the bottom read, "The Beckwith Building, 325-81. Reba said, "These are the old blue line drawings. I'm hoping they'll tell us what Beck's hiding and where he's hiding it." "Where'd you get these?" "We had multiples at the office, everything from framing plans to plumbing plans, heating and air conditioning, fixture requirements, you name it. Every time the architect made changes, he'd print out a new set of drawings for all the principals. Beck told me to toss them." "And you had the foresight to hang on to them. I'm impressed." "I wouldn't call it foresight. I just love the information. It's like looking at x-rays, all those cracks and bone spurs where you least expect them. Here, take a look at these and we'll compare notes. I realized last night we were going about this all wrong." She passed me the second batch of drawings on sheets of paper that must have measured 18 inches by 24. I wrestled the first sheet into a reasonably flat position and studied the particulars. As nearly as I could tell, this had something to do with the service entrance and electrical rooms, showing the location of the meter, the transformer vault, the switchgear, electrical closets, and individual circuits. The wiring diagrams were made up of circles and wavy lines, showing the relationship of outlets to controls. The next sheet was more interesting. It looked like a cutaway of one corner of the building from the rooftop down.
According to the legend at the bottom of the page, every eighth of an inch represented one linear foot. The architect had labeled every aspect of the drawing in that freehand block lettering students must be taught the very first day at architectural school. Reba glanced over, saying, "What they're using there for stabilization is a rigid core that runs down the center of the building, a structural tower that contains the restroom, stairs, and elevators. I remember them talking about diagonal bracing and sheer panels, whatever that means." I could see the concrete columns, the location of precast concrete spandrel panels, the slab on grade and concrete pile foundation, which was backed up by steel stud and drywall assembly. I was hoping to spot the correlation between the lines on the page and the spaces I'd seen. The detailed drawing of the rooftop, for instance, did show the mechanicals of the elevator equipment in roughly the same position as the fakey-looking gardener's cottage. Reba put a finger on the page. "I don't like it. That other drawing shows the elevators on the far side, not this. So, which is it?" "Maybe we should take another look," I said. "I don't get how anybody figures this shit out. I wouldn't know where to begin." Reba unfurled another floor plan, this one dated August of 81. We studied a couple of the drawings next to one another. Having seen the offices firsthand, I had a fair idea what I was looking at, with certain notable exceptions. Where the employee break room was located in reality, the floor plan indicated a conference room which had been moved closer to reception. "How many sets do you have?" "Tons, but these seemed the most relevant. From March to August, there's not that much difference. It's the changes that show up in October that looked interesting to me." She wrestled a fourth sheet open and placed it atop the third. Much crackling of paper as the two of us examined the specifics of employee restrooms, wheelchair clearances, metal decks, and rigid insulation, the whole of Beck's 15 office suite visible in one sweep. "Are we looking for anything in particular?" I asked. She pointed to an oblong area on my sheet, adjacent to fire stairs and the elevator envelopes. "See that? The location of the elevator shifted from there to there," she said, moving her finger from my drawing to hers. "Break room moved too, but so what?" "Well, look at it. I mean, I understand they made changes, but there's space unaccounted for. Here it's called storage, but in this drawing, the space is still there with no reference to it at all." "I still don't see the significance." "I just think it's odd. I'm telling you, there was a room there on one of the early floor plans. I asked Beck what it was, and he blew me off like I didn't need to know. On the initial blue line drawings, the architect labeled it a gun vault, which is totally ridiculous. Beck's a pussy about firearms. He doesn't even own one gun, let alone a collection of the damn things. At the time, I figured maybe it was a panic room or whatever you call them. A safe room? Like that. Something he didn't want anyone else to know about. Later, I wondered if he intended to use it as a love nest, a hidey hole where he could take his lady friends. I mean, what could be better? In the same building, but out of the public eye. Think how easy it'd be to get a little ass on the side. Maybe the architect vetoed the idea. Nobody vetoes him. He knows exactly what he wants, and he gets it. She laid a finger on an unmarked area just off reception. Couldn't there be space behind this wall? I went back in my mind and pictured the gallery of paintings and the trompe-l'oeil effect created by the diminishing sizes of objects as the eye traced them down the hall. I looked back at the floor plan. I don't think so. If there's a room there, how the heck do you get in? There aren't any doors in that wall that I remember. My recollection, too. Because I counted off five offices, and Ani's was in the middle. After Jude's office. You know the one with all the black and white photographs? Right, right. Yeah, well, the gallery picked up from there, and that wall had to be a good 25 feet long. What about that room where they kept office supplies? That's right there. I went around this part twice, and there weren't any doors there either, so if it's a room, it's been sealed. Maybe it's something to do with the building infrastructure. All the nuts and bolts stuff. Don't you have plans any later than this?
Reba shook her head. I was in prison by then. We were both silent for a moment. Then I said, too bad we don't have plans for the offices below his. You're just assuming that's a room, but it could be a mechanical chase or something that goes all the way down. She curled the plans together and made a cylinder of them, replacing the rubber band. She tossed them into the back seat and turned the key in the ignition. Only one way to find out.
Reba drove around the block, slowly circling Passage's shopping plaza, peering across me through the passenger side window as she scanned the exterior. On the south side of the mall, she pulled over to the curb, her attention taken up by an entrance marked Deliveries. A steep ramp led down into the shadows and out of sight.
Hang on, I gotta see this, she said.
She killed the engine and got out on her side of the car while I got out on mine. We walked down the ramp, which descended two levels to what must have been a sub-basement. At the foot of the ramp was a portcullis secured with a big, handsome padlock. Through the grillwork we could see 10 parking spaces, a blank double door at the end of a cul-de-sac, and a single metal door to the right. I said, "You think this is the only way in?"
"Can't be. When merchandise is delivered, there has to be some way to distribute goods to the individual stores."
We retraced our steps, huffing and puffing slightly as we made the climb. When we reached the sidewalk, she backed up a few steps, her gaze tracking the length of the building. At street level, along this aspect of the fortress-like structure, there were no shop windows and no access to retail establishments.
"Second ramp, just like this, down the block," she remarked. "Oh, wait a minute. I got it. Let's just see if I'm correct."
I looked at her. "Are you going to tell me or not?"
"If I'm right, of course. If I'm wrong, you don't need to know."
"You're very tedious." She smiled, unfazed. We returned to the car. She started the engine and glanced over her left shoulder to check for oncoming cars. She pulled out and continued her circuit of the mall, passing the twin of the entrance we'd just seen. She turned right at the corner and headed north on Chapel. At Passages, there was no charge for parking on weekends, probably to encourage spending. The gate to the underground parking lot was up. Reba turned in and eased her car down the ramp. At the bottom, she hung a right and drove the length of the garage, parking in a space near the darkened glass doors that marked the lower level entrance to Macy's. The store at this hour was still closed and wouldn't open until 10 o'clock. Reba pointed. 10 car lengths to our right, there was a nondescript door marked Service, No Admittance. Beyond that, the ramp for second, third, and fourth level parking spiraled up and out of sight.
"Won't that be locked?"
I asked, feeling that queasy sense of excitement at the notion of going where we weren't supposed to be.
"For sure. I told you I did some reconnoitering before, but I couldn't get in. Now I have these."
She held up the chunky ring of keys she'd snitched from Ani's desk. She sorted through the keys one by one, smiling at the sight.
"My, oh my. I'm sorry for every mean thing I ever said about that girl. Catch this."
Ani, Little Miss Compulsive, had labeled every key with a strip of neatly embossed tape. Office, Bex, Conference Room, Service Corps, Warehouse, S Elevator, S Deposit Mid-City, S Deposit Santa Teresa Savings and Low. Reba pinched the two safe deposit keys together and jangled the rest.
"Bet these contain a shitload of information. Safe deposit box is where Beck keeps his second set of books."
"A second set? That's not smart."
"Not real books. The information's all on disks. He's over there every couple of days, dropping off the updates. What's he gonna do? He's a businessman. Even if what he's doing is illegal, he still has to keep records. You think he doesn't have to provide a full accounting to Sallustio?"
"Sure, but it still seems risky."
"Beck adores taking risks. He's addicted to the rush."
"I can relate to that." Reba continued to finger the safe deposit keys.
Wonder if there's any way to get into these boxes.
Reba, I didn't say I'd do it. He changed banks the minute I went to prison, so I wouldn't be a signatory in any event. It's probably Marty now.
Swear you're going to put those back.
I told you I would, as soon as I've made dupes.
God damn it, Reba. Are you totally out of your mind?
Pretty much. She glanced back over her shoulder at the vast, empty garage. We better get going before someone else shows up. We got out of the car and walked to the service door, our footsteps echoing against the bare concrete walls. Reba tried the knob, locked, as anticipated, and then used the key Ani had so thoughtfully designated. The door opened into a stairwell. We walked down a flight and discovered two additional doors about 10 feet apart. Reba said, "The lady or the tiger? You pick." I pointed to the left. She shrugged and handed me the keys. I had to do a bit of experimenting to find the right one. Ani's paucity of imagination had resulted in her labeling some of the keys numerically. I tried 3 before I came to the one that worked. I unlocked the door and opened it. We found ourselves in the same 10 parking space cul-de-sac we'd seen from the street. Reba said, "Aha!" We closed the first door and moved to the second. "Your turn," I said. "I'd go for the key marked number 4. "No sweat. I already know it's behind this one." She eased the key into the lock and turned it and pushed the door open. We stood looking into a long, windowless corridor. Flats of fluorescent lights affixed to the ceiling lent a bluish cast to the air. At regular intervals, oversized metal doors on either side of the hall opened into the shipping and receiving departments of the various shops along the mall, some of which fronted Chapel Street and some on the mall's interior esplanade. Signs above the doors indicated the respective retailers, the luggage shop, a children's clothing store, an Italian pottery outlet, the jewelry store, and so on down the line. I studied the layout. There was no sign of the two elevators I'd seen in the lobby above, but a solid wall of concrete suggested the bottom of the shaft that housed them. A short distance away, a mirror located in the upper right-hand corner was tilted to reveal the alcove, reflecting an image of the service elevator and the second elevator I'd noticed on the lobby level. I started to move forward, but Reba extended her arm, effectively blocking me like the gate at a railroad crossing. She put a finger to her lips and pointed up and to the right. I spotted a corner-mounted security camera, its aperture focused squarely on the far end of the hall. There was a telephone attached to the wall, presumably to facilitate communication between the front desk and delivery men. We backed up and eased the door shut. Even so, she dropped her voice to an almost inaudible murmur. "After you dropped me off last night, I picked up my car and came back so I could chat with Willie. He's nice, not as tight-assed as you'd think. Big chess buff. Plays duplicate bridge, and I swear to God he bakes sourdough bread. Says he's had the same starter for 9 years. Whole time we're yakking, I'm checking out the monitors, all 10 of them, so I'll know what he sees. I was catching flashes of this view, but I didn't know where it was until we opened the door down here. Upstairs, he's got line of sight in both directions on all the hallways, but nothing in the elevators and nothing on the roof. What about Beck's offices? Oh, please, Beck wouldn't put up with that big brother shit. He doesn't mind Willie spying on his tenants, but not on him. Seems like heavy security for a building this size. Interesting, isn't it? I thought so myself. So where'd the elevators disappear to? The public elevators stop at lobby level. Clearly, Beck doesn't want anyone to have access to his offices from down here, she said. One elevator does a short loop between the parking garage and the lobby. Anybody who needs to reach floors 2, 3, or 4 has to exit into the lobby and cross to the public elevators. That way, Willie can intercept them and quiz them. You better have a pretty good reason for being in the building, or you're out of luck. If you need to take an elevator down this far, you have to have a key.
there isn't any button you can push. But if the service elevator originates down here, can't someone hop on down here and bypass Willard altogether? I asked. I mean, even with